Henry W. Grady, like many children in Georgia, had lost his father during the Civil War. But Henry wasn't the sort to moan about the past. An enterprising young journalist, he turned the Atlanta Constitution into one of the South's great newspapers, and he worked tirelessly to sell the South to the nation. In 1886, he told a VIP banquet in New York City,
"There was a South of slavery and secession. That South is dead. There is now a South of union and freedom. That South, thank God, is living, breathing, growing every hour. The old South rested everything on slavery and agriculture, unconscious that these could neither give nor maintain healthy growth. Now, the new South presents a perfect democracy, 100 farms for every plantation, 50 homes for every palace, and a diversified industry that meets the complex needs of this complex age."
On the face of it, the new South was there for all to see. During the 1880s, the region more than doubled its railroad mileage, opening up areas like West Virginia to profitable coal mining and creating hundreds of small towns whose needs stimulated economic growth. In 1900, Birmingham, Alabama was the 11th biggest city in the South, yet it had started from nothing in a cornfield 30 years before. Some enterprising real estate men saw that the local deposits of iron, coal and limestone were ideal for steelmaking. They deliberately adopted the name of England's great industrial metropolis to signal its potential. An icon of the industrial New South was James Buchanan Duke of North Carolina, known as Buck. This tall, rugged redhead turned his father's little tobacco company into an international giant. He invested in machines that fed in tobacco and paper at one end and churned out rolled cigarettes at the other. Previously, this was done by hand. An expert might manage 2,000 cigarettes in a day, but a machine could produce 100,000. Shrewd advertising, sharp practice, and ruthless mergers created the American Tobacco Company, which then divided up the world with its British rivals. Like most industrial tycoons, Duke presented his success as a classic rags-to-riches American story.
"I have succeeded in business not because I have more natural ability than those who have not succeeded, but because I have applied myself harder and stuck to it longer. I had confidence in myself. I loved business better than anything else. I worked from early morning until late at night. Any young man can succeed if he is willing to apply himself. Superior brains are not necessary."
But despite the real changes in the late 19th century, much of the South remained set in old ways. The region was still overwhelmingly agricultural, with cotton even more pervasive than before. And although the old slave plantations had gone, the planters bounced back, often joined as major landholders by the owners of local general stores. These men had a monopoly of business on their patch, growing rich by charging extortionate interest on unpaid bills and investing their wealth in land. This new elite, the old planters and the more recent landowners, dominated the economy of the new South. Slavery had gone, but what replaced it, known as sharecropping, was often almost as bad. Most blacks and many poor whites lacked the means to farm on their own, so they received land and basic housing from a landowner in return for giving him a half share of the crop. And because they could not afford to buy their own seed and equipment, the landowner advanced them the money for this on credit, driving them further into debt. They ended up bound almost as tightly as if they'd been slaves. Even if not a tenant, you could end up in debt to the boss. One black farm worker in Georgia, we don't know his name, recorded what happened when he came, as he thought, to the end of his labour contract. His employer, a state senator,
"said to some of us with a smile, and I never will forget that smile. I can see it now. Boys, I'm sorry you're going to leave me. I hope you will do well in your new place. So well that you will be able to pay me the little balances which most of you owe me.
According to the storekeeper's books, his debt was $165. Most of his friends owed between $100 and $200. But they were told that after signing an account of their debts, they could go and seek new employment. The blacks were, however, illiterate, and...
We would have signed anything just to get away. So we stepped up, we did, and made our marks.
That night, they were locked up, together with convicts leased from the local prison.
The next morning, it was explained to us by the two guards appointed to watch us that, in the papers we had signed the day before, we had not only made acknowledgement of our indebtedness, but that we had also agreed to work for the senator until the debts were paid by hard labor. Really, we had made ourselves lifetime slaves.
It took him 3 years' hard labor to pay off his debts. And so, for many black workers and sharecroppers, the New South was little better than the old. Given that the North had lost interest in Reconstruction, the blacks had to make the best they could of the situation. That, at least, was the view of Booker T. Washington, a former slave from Virginia who became head of the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. His goal was to produce a network of schools and teachers that would provide basic education for blacks. His philosophy of self-help and hard work won the financial support of many white businessmen and politicians, and Washington became the first African-American to be invited as a dinner guest at the White House. Washington urged his own people to focus for the moment on economic advancement, not political rights.
The wisest among my race understand that the agitation of questions of social equality is the extremest folly. No race that has anything to contribute to the markets of the world is long in any degree ostracized. It is important and right that all privileges of the law be ours, but it is vastly more important that we be prepared for the exercise of those privileges. The opportunity to earn a dollar in the factory just now is worth infinitely more than the opportunity to spend a dollar in the opera house.
Behind the scenes, Washington was more assertive, for instance, funding court cases in support of black rights. But his public stance was regarded by many blacks as obsequious and misguided. The most tenacious critic was Burkhart Du Bois, a free black from Massachusetts who'd earned a PhD from Harvard. Du Bois insisted that black people could progress only if the talented tenth of exceptional men were educated for leadership and an active struggle for civil rights. He called Washington the Great Accommodator.
Mr. Washington distinctly asks that black people concentrate all their energies on industrial education, the accumulation of wealth, and the conciliation of the South. What has been the return? 1. The disenfranchisement of the Negro. 2. The legal creation of a distinct status of civil inferiority for the Negro. 3. The steady withdrawal of aid from institutions for the higher training of the Negro.
How, asked Du Bois indignantly, could black Southerners
make effective progress in economic lines if they are deprived of political rights, made a servile caste, and allowed only the most meager chance for developing their exceptional men?
Washington and Du Bois offered different strategies for dealing with white supremacy in the New South. Incremental economic progress within the system or active political opposition against it. They appealed particularly to the black middle class that was emerging in the new southern towns and cities, teachers, lawyers, ministers or bankers, catering for black needs in an increasingly segregated urban society. Among these people was Mike King. He started out as a sharecropper in rural Georgia, day after day spent ploughing behind a mule. Defiantly, he shouted,
I may smell like a mule, but I don't think like a mule.
Mike made it to Atlanta, working days as a mechanic or a railroad fireman, and nights gaining his education. Eventually, he completed a degree in divinity and became a Baptist pastor. He renamed himself and his young son after the founding father of Protestantism, Martin Luther King. In the Old South, the place of blacks was clearly defined. Most were slaves. But in the New South, all people were free. So conservatives drew a new dividing line, white or black. Under what were known obscurely as the Jim Crow laws, black and white were separated in public places, schools, restaurants, housing, even cemeteries. Transport was a particularly sensitive arena, but as Du Bois discovered after riding on a southern train...
The Jim Crow car is up next to the baggage car and engine. It stops out beyond the covering in the rain or sun or dust. Your compartment is a half or a quarter or an eighth of the oldest car in service on the railroad. Unless it happens to be a through express, the plush is caked with dirt, the floor is grimy, and the windows dirty. It is difficult to get lunch or clean water. Lunchrooms either don't serve niggers or serve them at some dirty and ill-attended hole in the wall. As for toilet rooms, don't.
Not all blacks were willing to accept such discrimination. In Louisiana, Homer Plessy, a light-skinned black, deliberately sat in a whites-only part of a train. After refusing to budge, he was arrested and jailed. Plessy and his supporters took the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it was rejected in January 1896 with only one dissenting vote. Plessy had based his argument on the 14th Amendment, enacted after the Civil War to affirm the equal rights of all citizens. But according to the court, the amendment
could not have been intended to abolish distinctions based upon color or to enforce social, as distinguished from political, equality.
The court judged that any state was
at liberty to act with reference to the established usages, customs, and traditions of the people, and with a view to the promotion of their comfort and the preservation of the public peace and good order.
The Plessy case was a landmark decision. The Supreme Court affirmed that segregation was constitutional as long as the facilities were separate but equal. That, of course, was rarely the case, but the court also stated that it was up to the states, not the federal government, to maintain equal standards. The court also rejected another assumption of Plessy's case.
That social prejudices may be overcome by legislation, and that equal rights cannot be secured to the Negro except by an enforced commingling of the two races. We cannot accept this proposition. If the two races are to meet upon terms of social equality, it must be the result of natural affinities, a mutual appreciation of each other's merits, and a voluntary consent of individuals.
It would be over half a century before the Supreme Court changed its mind about the enforced commingling of races. When it finally overturned the Plessy separate but equal verdict in 1954, this opened the floodgates to affirmative action on behalf of black rights. And on the crest of the wave would be Mike King's son, Martin Luther King, Jr.